Paul Checker, how the devil are you?
Very good, thank you. Rusty, how are you, mate?
I'm good. I feel like I spend like a reasonable amount of time with you in this kind of period of the year, probably more than my wife. I've been away from the country for 2 months so far this year, so I might have spent more time with you than my wife.
That's very possible. Yeah, we see each other fairly. The cadence is quite regular, isn't it, with the work that we're doing. So
Yeah, and again in May.
yes, yeah, we'll be there again in the room together,
2 days in May.
scaring people together. Yeah.
Oh, nice. Cool.
Yeah.
What do you want to, apart from like hanging out with me every so often, what do you want to explain what it is that you do?
Let me do that. So yeah, I'm sort of in a second career mode, I think that's fair to say. So I started life as an actor. I'd studied at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, left there in 98, and had a good sort of 20 years as an actor, treading the boards, making some pretty dreadful telly when I look back on it at the time.
What
If
was the most dreadful telly you did?
I know it wasn't dreadful, but I was in a show on Channel 4 for a number of years called As If. Used to be on. Remember As If?
Yeah, I
Yeah.
remember As If.
Yeah, so I was a regular on that for
I didn't
4 years.
watch it, but I'm aware of it.
Okay, yeah, there you go. Yeah. So we made 76 of those, and that was my sort of introduction to the world of acting, was through that show essentially. And yeah, it was a fantastic time. But yeah, looking back at it now, some of the things I did on that show were highly embarrassing, and I'm glad it's not on any streaming service now. You know, it's yeah, dressed up in a few outfits which I wouldn't want people to see. And you know, after that, mostly sort of TV and theatre, but made a film as well in my early days with Maggie Smith and Judi Dench and Cher. So that was
Oh,
awesome
wow.
experience. That was my first job actually. It was a film called Tea with Mussolini. I had to play Maggie Smith's grandson. And absolutely, you know, I look back on that.
Did you get to hang with Cher a bit?
Yeah, we hung out with Cher. Yeah, we chatted briefly.
Didn't realize you were so big time.
It was amazing seeing her record. Actually, she had a record out this year, I think, earlier this year, and just watching her perform it, and you're going, "Wow, that's exactly what you looked like
Yeah,
25
she's
years
like
ago." And I thought,
90 now, but yeah.
it was amazing, amazing woman.
Wow.
But yeah, so no, so really good time as an actor, and sort of got to, I suppose, the 15-year mark as an actor, and sort of started wanting to do other things. And I suppose but the turning point was children, probably, for me, wanting to settle down and not be quite so inconsistent with the work that I was doing, wanting to have a bit more control over how I spent my time, let's just put it that way. And so I got into the world of trade training and development, and the route in for that for most actors is the world of how to present better, you know, presentation skills, and
Yeah.
yeah, stand up and engage people with confidence and create some impact in the way that you're doing things. And so there's obviously a lot of layering you can do as an actor with people in the industry who have to present. You can add a lot of value for people. So that was the first sort of step into this world of learning and development that we're in. And since then, you know, over the last 15 years, I've just built and built what I do, and it's branched out and become many, many different things. And I'm now a sort of certified coach, and do a bit of coaching as well as teaching and facilitation. And I'm still using my acting skills, as well, you know, Rusty, with a bit of forum theatre and a bit of real play or role play, however you like to call it. So for the work we do on challenging conversations, and that again, it has real value for people when you're seeing that played out in front of you, or having an actor on the other side of that conversation with you. It's incredibly valuable, I think.
The feedback from coaches. It's my favourite workshop, by the way. No offence to any other workshops that the Premier League do. But the feedback from the coaches is inevitably, oh, I could have done with that a couple of years ago.
Right.
Because, like, and the challenging conversations or hard conversations or conversations around difference are, like, often avoided in sport, in my experience. And especially when you can't use the hierarchy card. So
Yeah.
some of the scenarios we do, you can pull the hierarchy card out. But if you can't, which is, you know, if you're starting down at the bottom as a coach in a football academy, then you actually need to be really skillful, don't you?
It's a real skill, yeah. Working upwards is a real challenge for people, and that plays out, doesn't it, in the scenarios that they've got at the Premier League.
Is that a common thing? So you when you're working with, and I know you work with that mission, like mission performance, is that a big part of your work is it around the challenging conversations?
Yeah, this is a big part of what we do. Yeah, so Mission Performance do and consultancy that work in leadership, communication skills. There's a coaching sort of pillar to their work, and then they've also got a human factors pillar, which is, I don't know if you know much about human factors, but it's
Yep.
high-risk environments, how to keep people safe and performing at their best. So the communications team work across all of those different areas when it comes to crucial conversations, because it's such a key thing that, like you said, people avoid doing it. People don't like having them. I don't like having them. They're not an easy thing to do. As a team, we work quite extensively within that world, with leadership, with managers, with people on operational people. The whole idea of having a voice and speaking up and being able to challenge and contribute in environments where hierarchy exists and in cultures where hierarchy exists, that's a really tough thing for people to get the hang of.
Yeah, I mean, culturally, even if you think about rugby coaches, lots of them will go and coach in countries like Japan where, hierarchy shame are really important things. So, let's start off with I guess you do a few bits with us that maybe we'll give people a bit of a summary of. One is status. So, I think one of my favorite things is when you act out the governor, and I think you do something like, "I am here, everybody," or you do something like that, don't you?
So status, just to sort of clarify what that is and what how we use it. Obviously, we think about status in lots of different ways. The way that we bring status into the room is from an acting perspective. And as an actor, you play with status all the time, and seeing how your own status interacts with other people's status, and the comedy and the drama that that can create in a play or on the telly or something. Writers and dramatists use it all the time. The essence of it is about sort of that ego that you have about yourself, how you see yourself in relation to other people, and whether you see yourself as worthy as somebody else, or less worthy, or more worthy than somebody else, then that can really bleed through in your behavior and how you communicate with that person in that moment. And so, we talk about that adult to adult, that whole Eric Byrne child, adult, parent thing. It's that. How do we get to the middle ground, that balance between confidence, being confident without being arrogant, and being humble without being meek. So that balance of confidence and humility, which is really difficult to find, but I think is present in all good, challenging conversations.
And I'm reminded you played them out, and obviously you do show me more than tell me. So you would be playing out the kind of the warrior who's like made themselves quite small,
Yeah,
and then
that's
you
right.
playing out the governor who might be holding a stare for quite a period of time and like looking like they know what they're doing. And then I was thinking of you the other day when I picked up my car from the airport, which I'm sure no one's ever said to you. But there were it's meet and greet, but it wasn't meet and greet. It was like 90 minutes late. And so, but when the guy turned up, he was so adult, I had no other option. He was just like, "Hey, Mr. Earnshaw, you came. We're really sorry." Like, did it. And I really wanted to be angry. But I just couldn't be angry with it.
Because he dealt with you in the right way.
I
It's that.
couldn't do it.
And I think so much of that adult behavior is about empathy, isn't it? I was with my mum the other day, and she was waiting. I went to the doctor's with her. She just wanted to have a second ear with the doctor. And the doctor was an hour and a half, kept us waiting in the waiting room for an hour and a half. And we walked in, and there was no mention of the fact that she kept us waiting for an hour and a half. And that really affected me for the rest of the meeting. It's like, you know what? The sort of there's an arrogance to that, but it's not necessarily an arrogant. Her intention isn't that, right? It's not the intention, but the effect is, wow, we aren't worthy enough to be sort of really sorry. Just it takes a second, doesn't it, to say, I know we've kept you, I'm really sorry. How can I help?
Yeah, and I just thought it was cool for the coaches to play around with like different statuses to try and work out how another person was behaving, and then actually you've got to like notice that and then probably adapt your behaviours to that.
Yeah, that's right. And that's not a straightforward thing to do. That's not it's really complicated, isn't it, to see, okay, how is this person feeling about themselves and about me in this room? And what does that mean I should be, how should I be behaving in order to make this relationship work? That's quite a juggle. I suppose the thing is, we always want to be getting back to that adult, and we want the other person to be adult. So how can we bring them there, and how can we, give them, allow their ego to exist in the way that they want it to exist, but not challenging it, but to bring them to a place which is useful and practical for us to have a decent conversation.
And to paint a picture of what actually happens, so coaches will go into a room with you and they'll be mic'd and videoed and you'll play out some scenarios and then some other people will be observing and we'll reflect upon that. And you might pause and replay some of that stuff in the moment. So you might actually, there's one that I remembered, which is a classic one in sport of you're trying to influence upwards. So I think we call the scenario like three drills, and it's the coach that always does the same three drills, but it's, he's won lots of games, he's been there for years, like, and I think a couple of the coaches came in and, he's acting like the governor, and they came in a bit like, okay, I think I can help you. And he's thinking, I don't want your help. Like, so I'm just understanding actually, how do you go meet someone perhaps a bit closer to where they are, rather than like really annoy them by doing that.
I think that whole thing about trying to match somebody else's status can be a really dangerous thing to do. So if you've got someone who is giving off that sort of, as you said, the governor essence of about somebody who wants to be in charge, wants to be in control of things, wants to be the boss in the room, has that energy about them, and you go in matching that energy, hoping to achieve something out of them, especially if you're lower down the hierarchy, then you're in, you're probably gonna trip over on that one, I think.
Yeah, it just reminded me of when I used to work at the RFU. We had an old boss and who definitely thought he was the governor. And even if there was four or five of us sat around the table, he would stand up, and so we'd all be sat down and he'd stand up. And Fletch, who's a legend, Fletch actually played around with a period of time of every time Dean stood up, Fletch stood up as well, which was like, and then there'd be like two or three of us sat down, which was, I think, like, thinking about what you said there, like, you might have thought that might have like lit a fire, but actually I think he was so shocked by what was going on that he didn't quite know what to do. Anyway, it was just an experiment Fletch tried for a bit. And then I guess the other thing that I love that you guys and girls do is the forum theatre stuff. So I've kind of nicked it a bit and used it in other spheres, but it just seems like such a clever way of doing things, really, to help, I guess, novices see stuff and maybe start to be in the third person. Do you want to talk about how you do that stuff?
So I think that's the, if whenever you go to the theatre, that's what it's doing. It's holding up a bit of a mirror for you, isn't it? It's saying, in different plays and different times, say different things about society. And the best plays live long because there's something which is communicated in them, which is timeless. And I think that's what good theatre does. It holds a mirror up and says, how does this look like for you in your life? And that's why we use forum theatre for businesses, is for exactly the same reason that, it allows them a safe space. They're not having to participate necessarily. They can sit back and watch and observe, but it can be something that they connect with and can reflect into their own lives and bring back into their own, they can personalize it. So it's really useful for that. And the key thing with forum theatre is you've got one of the characters in that scene is a changeable character. So and the audience get to participate and contribute to what's happening in the scene by changing the actions of one of those characters. So it's normally led by two actors who've got the experience to do that, and the experience to adapt and flex with what the notes or the feedback that you're getting from the audience. But they get to, a bit of a remote control thing going on with the audience. So it can be quite exciting, and it can lead to really good discussions. And we tend to do it at the beginning of something, so people experience that before they then go into having to do a bit of that themselves with an actor.
Yeah, and just to paint a picture of it, so it would be like me and you playing out a conversation. You might be like sacking me, as an example, and other people observe it around us, and then, we might pause, and then okay, like, and if you're the adjustable character, then actually, like, what piece of advice would you give to Paul, or if you could change one thing, what would you change, or, and then we redo the same situation, but and you adapt.
Exactly that,
I've done
yeah.
it with both characters changeable. That might not be right, but I've played around with what one piece of advice would you give for Paul? What point piece of advice would you give for Rusty? Because often the person receiving, for example, feedback might not do that particularly well. And then what would be that the one maybe the one thing you loved about this conversation, or the one thing that you would keep? So, but then we just kind of play around with that scenario and look it up, because it's ultimately about options, isn't it?
It is. It's about flexing, isn't it? As a human being, and what different approaches can you take to those conversations? So I think it's absolutely fine to allow two adaptable characters in that scene. It's play, isn't it? At the end of the day, that's what you do. So it's having some fun with it and extracting what you can from it. But yeah, no, it can be a really powerful thing to do.
I think it's amazing. Like, people are blown away by it. So I'll do it. I'll do it without telling people that I'm going to do it. So me and you would, you might walk into the room and we play out this scenario, and then people are actually have this kind of emotional response as well, because they're like, oh my God, Rusty and Paul are having an argument, and this isn't a very good conversation. I try and give them some good stuff as well, obviously.
Yeah.
But it's gone down well with teams, I guess. Is that like the challenging conversations? Are you finding that that's like is becoming more and more critical in organizations?
I think the idea of people being able to say what's on their mind, be candid, challenge and contribute, that's the key thing. And if you know, ideally, we don't want to be getting to the point in a relationship, a working relationship, where we're having to have a challenging conversation. You know, it's getting to the point where if we're working well and there's a good, nice, quick feedback loop, as you described with your colleague earlier, then if we're able to not sit on stuff for too long and have open discussion, then we're not needing to get to those points where we're doing this. And it's not always avoidable, but sometimes we can. We can work at not having to have them.
Yeah, I think I work with two coaches, Joe and Clarkie, who are both excellent at this. And something wouldn't be allowed to go for more than 24 hours. And then the flip is, I spoke to a coach this week who's at a Premiership rugby club, and you would think he would be having the time of his life, and he just said, "Yeah, I'm like finding it pretty hard the way I get spoken to by the head coach." And I was like, "Would you ever challenge the head coach?" And he went, "Yeah, I probably should." And it's like, oh, this is making me really sad. Like, you should be like loving your job, and this is making me really sad.
Yeah.
And what have you learned? So what, like, across all the kind of the workshops you've done around the challenging conversations, what would be like your two or three kind of top tips? And maybe I'll add a bit of color with the stuff I've learned along the way as well.
I think giving people a bit of structure. And spending 5 minutes before I have the conversation, thinking about what I want to get out of it, how am I going to communicate that, and what do I need to say to motivate the other person to have this conversation, I think is really key. And so just, you know, creating a bit of clarity as well around the message and making sure that we both know the conversation we're in is important. So I think preparation is probably the best thing you can do if you're going to have a challenging conversation, is spend a bit of time thinking about what it is you're going to say and how you're going to say it.
Yeah, I did some work with a club this year, and I was like, oh, stand up if you think you'd have more points in the league if you were better at this. Stay standing if you're practicing it and planning it. And of course, like, there's only like two people left standing. And interestingly, both of them like were practicing and talking about structure with the team manager in advance of meetings that were hierarchically upwards. But yeah, that kind of thinking about, well, what's my first line going to be? What's my
Yeah.
statement of intent?
Yeah.
When am I going to pause? What questions am I going to ask you? That's something that's like really hit me, is that they get often, like, we get this wheel of death going on, like, well, you know, and we get more and more animated, and actually people really struggle to, when we've got stuck, to have this kind of killer question, or to be able to take one step back and go, can we just draw a line under this? Can we, like,
Yeah, knowing when to pause the conversation and just reset it a little bit. And yeah, if you can feel the energy spiraling into a really negative, unhelpful place, just pausing and stepping away if you have to, and picking it up again in 10 minutes or the next day, and not allowing it to get to that place. And that's about noticing that happening, isn't it? And being able to have the composure to sort of put a pause on.
I think noticing skills are super important, and
Yeah.
again, I think you guys and gals are the best noticers I see.
It's quite hard noticing when you're in the middle of the
Yeah, but I think because it's a bit like when a coach starts. So when a coach starts out, they're so focused on the practice and where the cones go and what I think is going to happen that that's where their attention is.
Yeah.
And because you don't, because you have the skills to be able to have the conversation, you actually can focus less on yourself. You're kind of doing a lot of it without having to necessarily think about it. And you can focus on the other person and their reaction to things, and and what they do as a result, and then adapt yourself as more skill, as coaches become more and more skillful, they notice different things, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think that is so the noticing thing, but that requires, like you say, it requires a bit of experience and composure to be able to do that and not to be too caught up in your own emotional and in your own headspace. And that sort of awareness is quite hard to master. So I suppose one of the key things about any of these conversations is, am I allowing myself time in it? Is it okay to have a pause and to think? You know, and that's really hard, isn't it? That's really that whole breathing thing, and just feeling yourself into a conversation without feeling the need to respond instantly. I can the thinking time is really important in these conversations.
Yeah, I worked with a few coaches who would use a pen and a paper, and they started. I think they often will do it in the challenging conversations just to create time for themselves to pause and think.
Yeah, you can be doodling and drawing anything you like, but it's giving yourself that space.
Which are your most memorable conversations you've done? And I got ones that you go, oh, that one was like a bit spicy, or oh, that one was, I learned lots from that one, or.
Yeah. Well, I had one last. I think it was with you actually. One of the ones I did last session was sticking in my head, which was it's the retain and release, and that's such a tough conversation,
Oh my God.
and oh, you know, that's one of those difficult conversations which is quite distinct from a conversation where I'm working at building some influence or trying to achieve something, or it's no sense of collaboration in retain and release because you're going into a room and telling somebody that the contract's not being renewed.
Yes, to just give it context, obviously lots of the football coaches will do a reasonable number of retain and release conversations each year, and so we would practice them with you, the actors, being the parents who are getting given this information, and then you kind of adjusting your reaction, sometimes screaming, sometimes shouting, sometimes crying, sometimes going dead quiet. All of those are, we actually probably, I was chatting to someone about this the other day. Like, I think one of the things about when you're having a challenging conversation with someone you know well and you work with regularly is you probably kind of know how they're going to react. Whereas some of these conversations, especially if they feel like a surprise to someone, you have no idea how someone's going to react. So your ability to deal with all types of reactions is probably super important.
Especially in a conversation where it's not going anywhere beyond the bad news you're delivering, you know. Yeah, so how can I, it's very hard to get somebody to walk out of the room at the end of that conversation feeling good about it. You know, you're not going to get there, it's not going to be achieved. So it's how can I show enough empathy? And that's a word we haven't mentioned yet, but empathy is so key in these conversations. How can I deliver this with enough empathy for them to feel like, not that it's okay, but yeah, that couldn't have been given to me in a better way.
Yeah.
The whole
It's
bedside
not a
manner.
win-win conversation. What's the one you're remembering?
See.
Is it the one where you said, oh, this is all good, like 3 weeks ago you said it's going really well, and because that's another thing that happens. So Joe, who I work with in France, he learned the hard way. He said, I learned never to make a promise as a coach.
Right.
And so again, we can often like be a bit worried about this release conversation, and we're not telling, we're speaking to someone a month before, and we might be going, yeah, it's going really well.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that's a really hard balancing act because you don't want that as being the retain and release thing at the end of a season to be like a sword hanging over your head through the whole season. Right? You want to be instilling belief and positivity in the team and in your players, but then at the end of the day, yeah, I suppose you have to tee it up a little bit. It shouldn't be a complete surprise to someone if they're being released, but it's a
What
really
was that the conversation that you were thinking about?
that was that one, yeah. And I suppose I enjoyed that one. I'm thinking of the one that I enjoyed a lot because there was a he was very good, I thought. And when you've got someone in front of you doing a good job, it allows you to be a little bit more naughty maybe with what your own responses and chat, just push it a little bit further and see how much you can stretch them. And so we had in that second the consequence scenario from the first one, we had the director of football coming in who I was friends with and gave him a much more tricky situation to deal with. He
Yeah,
seemed a bit,
just again to give it context, like
yeah.
we take a scenario and then we add the next level to it. So if they've done well, then they might have brought in, and yeah, that one brought in a head of football, didn't they? And you were like being really pally pally with him, and then suddenly it's two against one, and it's a bit more of a challenging conversation than it was the day before. Do
So
you
no,
want? Sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, I think it's always it's a little bit, I guess, like sport. You can do all that prep we've talked about. You can take that preparation, but of course, as soon as you get into the room in real life with somebody to have a challenging conversation, like you say, sometimes you might feel like you know what you're going to get, but you can't plan for beyond the first words that come out of your mouth because you don't know what you're going to get back. And so beyond that preparation, you have to be able to, I think that the key skills are good questions, listening really well, and you've got to be communicating with empathy for their perspective and what might be happening for them.
Show me what empathy would look like, if you were communicating with empathy on a retain and release.
I think playing things back is a really good thing to do, just to make sure that they feel they've been heard. So sort of clarifying. Asking for their perspective. There's that whole the Chris Voss technique. I don't know if you know the Chris Voss technique of seems like, sounds
Yeah,
like.
throughout the
Yeah,
label, throughout the label.
throw the label. Just connect with their emotional place that they are in
Yeah.
a way which is demonstrated. And I think that can really help. And spend some time again in preparation, thinking through that perspective. So, what might this look like from their point of view? How might they react, and how might they feel about this conversation happening?
She's hard to do when we're the heroes in our own stories.
That is the challenge, isn't it?
It made
Getting
me,
out of your own
because it
skin.
happened a couple of times, and I think, and Vic. I remember Vic like getting quite angry at this point, where someone tried to tell the parents how they were feeling, as opposed to, as you said, like just throwing something out there. Oh, it seems to me like you're pretty angry. No, I'm not. I am angry. Or yeah, a couple of times people said, oh, I can tell that you're angry. No, I'm not angry, I'm furious. Like, yeah, I think what again, like that time to plan. Like if this happens, then this, like, let's pre-mortem this conversation. Made me think again, you go into lots of businesses and lots of places and do this. Like, do you get the sense that anyone's practicing it deliberately?
No,
Yeah,
very rarely, very
like,
rarely.
it's so important, isn't it?
Everyone knows it's hard. And most people, like you say, will avoid challenging conversation if they can. But I do think it's about cadence. Making it easy is about culturally. Are we in a place where we can do this regularly? And inviting that challenge and inviting those opinions is also massively important if you're a leader, right? Because if you don't ask, you may never know, because people don't. They don't want to speak up. They don't want to challenge you. It's a difficult thing for people to do. And so I think you've got to invite it. I think that's a key skill.
I like the idea that it could be happening in the environment, and then you just call, okay, freeze, no one move. Like, okay, bit of advice here for this person. And we could just create the forum theatre in quite a, I think that would defuse some bombs, if I'm honest. When it's really like, okay, cool, everyone like, just take three breaths. We're gonna actually like, we're gonna, let's just replay this conversation. Let's take it back like a minute or so, like, how can we do this differently? And you could do that in, you could recreate that type of stuff in most meetings, and just get, and just normalize it, really. I think that's, it just becomes normal that
That's it.
we have conversations around how we're more skillful at this.
Normalizing it is really important.
What other stuff do you do? So I'm interested now, like, what other stuff, as well as like the challenging conversations, do you do?
So we do Mission Performance do a lot of work with leaders and leadership teams, senior leadership teams. We've got a program at the moment called the Pivot Leadership Program, which is sort of starting with self, thinking about values, purpose, before we start layering in sort of skills and abilities and practices for leaders to take on. So that whole thing of self-awareness and asking yourself some pretty deep, meaningful questions about what's getting you out of bed in the morning, and why are you taking the actions you're taking? So the motivation and purpose behind, what's your intent, and what is it you're trying to do? When you wake up in the morning and go to work, it could be any job. What's in it for you?
Yeah.
Finding that is so important for people, because if they haven't got that, it can be a much tougher gig.
And you find that people think you've shown them fire when you do this. Sometimes.
Sometimes I think it can be hard things for it can feel like, oh, this is a little bit, this is a bit,
Pink and fluffy.
pink and fluffy. Yeah, that's the danger, isn't it? That you it can. So it has to be, you have to root it in the end, I think, to something which is what we try and do. We give them the space to have conversations that get them to those places where they are thinking and considering that stuff. But then it has to be rooted to, well, what does this mean for the application in your work? Yeah, but how does having that as a bit of a purpose statement affect how you're going to communicate with your team tomorrow and the next day?
Like linking it to performance. I was also thinking like you almost lots of people don't even understand their own user manual, do they?
No,
Like what's the stuff that under pressure I dot dot dot, to get the best out of me dot dot dot. I'm avoiding challenging conversations because dot dot dot, like they don't interrogate that stuff. We just like we're just on the hamster wheel, so that ability to step back and create your own little car manual might be helpful.
yeah, I think it's very useful, and we try and do that initially without it, just through conversations and sort of thinking partnerships with in pairs. But of course, there is also a shortcut to some of this stuff, which is, get yourself a psychometric, and that will tell you everything you need to know about yourself. And some of those you really connect with, and other ones you don't. And the one we're using for this pivot program is called the SDI, the Strengths Deployment Inventory. Do you know it?
No.
Okay. It's the triangle, three colors on the triangle, but I love it. It's sort of, I think it's a standout psychometric, because it doesn't just give you sort of, this is the type of person you are, and this is the way you might behave in certain situations. It sort of goes a layer beyond that. It gets under the bonnet a bit more, and it talks about why, you see, you're either what's your actually motivating you. You've got a motivational value, and if you move away from that, you're always going to feel a little bit more uncomfortable than you would be if you were right in it. And so when you're deploying a strength, what's your motivation for deploying that strength? And so it gets to purpose, and it gets to values in a really clean way, which feels, really relatable. And the other benefit of using something like that is common language. And I think that's so important in an organization, is that we've all been through something where we can discuss this going forward in a way which makes sense to all of us. And that common language can be really powerful, because otherwise, how do we talk about it? If we and so that simple coloring and that simple idea of what strengths am I deploying, and am I overdoing this strength right now? I think that's that it's key to be able to talk about these things in a way which
Yeah,
you.
we use Spotlight probably pretty similarly, but again, I would try and go the layer below and get people to understand the
Yeah, I'm
why
not familiar with
behind it.
Spotlight. Yeah, I don't know that one.
Or we should compare and contrast. Tell me about your experience. I'm just curious about like, so when you come together for the Premier League stuff and you get all of a load of you together, and I'm just curious about your experience. Obviously, I have an amazing time, and I'm probably not even that aware, but like. What's it like for you compared to like other stuff? And I'm just curious.
Yeah, it's one of those gigs which is, hey, well, are you working for the Premier League, which feels great. If you're a football
Get
fan,
nice
that
pens. Get nice
yeah, nice pens, nice pads, nice bit of lunch,
pens.
yeah, it's exciting working with football coaches if you're a football fan. I'm a Portsmouth fan, so we just got promoted back to the
Right.
Championship last weekend. We got a brilliant, brilliant night at Fratton Park, and so yeah, if you care about football and you love watching football, working with the Premier League's fantastic job to have. So, A, there's that for me. I'm always excited to go and work with football coaches. And it's also one of those jobs which I don't really do the forum theatre and the acting for industry outside of the
Don't
Premier
you?
League. No, very rarely, very rarely. There's
Mate,
one.
I think it's like your finest work, the Forum Theatre. It's so good.
Oh, good.
Do
Thanks.
you do the Forum Theatre with businesses?
We do, but it's not, it's pretty rare, actually. Yeah, we
Oh,
do.
I think it's your finest work.
Yeah, well, that's good to know.
Should
Good
do
to know.
it more often.
We should do it more often. So yeah, what I like about it is I get to do a bit of acting again. In quite, it's, I wouldn't say it's low pressure, but it's lower pressure than stepping onto a stage in front of 1,000 people and having to perform in front of them or having a load of TV cameras around you and having to do
And
it. So,
were you good at that back in the day?
oh yeah, oh absolutely. In my 20s, just the confidence was just dripping off of me for that stuff. I had no issues, And as I got into my early 40s, yeah, my last play I did was at the Southwark Playhouse, and I was so nervous every night. Yeah, really, really big change. And
How did it end up like that? So I'm curious about that because again, this is, for coaches, for leaders, like the stuff you talk about, like presenting is like one of our biggest fears, isn't it? Like standing up in front of people and being judged and maybe getting it wrong. And the reality of, I just think of, even just think about, you're a grassroots rugby coach. You're probably a parent of a child. You're coaching. There could be like 40 parents watching you. It's actually quite a public thing to do. Lots of people have got an opinion on what good coaching looks like, So, like that kind of, I am curious about that. Like, well, I'm curious about, just that's just an interesting because my sense is that I probably feel like I got more confident the more skillful I got. But of course, you have bits where you realize you're not as good as you thought you were.
I think it's a really personal journey, isn't it? Confidence and where you and confidence in different situations. I'm much more confident as a facilitator now than I was 15 years ago,
Okay.
but I'd be much less confident as an actor now
Yeah.
than I was 15 years ago. So, I don't. It's really hard to put my finger on it, but I think in your 20s, you're just loving it and you're just going for it, and it's everything's you're sponging it all up. And by the time I got to 40s, I'd done it, everything I wanted to do. I ticked all the boxes really, and it just felt like, oh, it just felt more edgy for me. Felt more, I don't know. Maybe I just felt like there was. I suddenly became aware of the precariousness of it and the vulnerability of it, and it
And
yeah.
what and how does that translate into? I'm just curious about your stuff around presenting. We're doing some stuff around classroom coaching, which again is like a different skill to some of the stuff we're talking about. What how would like how's your presenting workshops go?
Yeah, they're the most enjoyable ones to deliver from the point of view of seeing progress.
Yeah.
When you walk into a room at the beginning of a day and you watch someone present, you go, okay, well, I know how to help you.
Yeah.
The synchronicity is pretty immediate. And then by the end of the 2 or 3 days, however long you've got them for, you've got them to a much happier place, more confident place, and with some real skills to take away and use. So they're very enjoyable from that perspective because.
What's the top two or three kind of things you find you can help with?
Focus is a big thing, and I think that's something we always talk about at Mission Performance in the presentation skills classes we do there, is about making it about the audience and not, too many people under that pressure are concerned with self. I'm just concerned for myself in this situation, and it really this really simple idea of, I'm not going to worry about how the impact audience are impacting me. I'm going to worry with myself about how I'm going to impact them, and it, when you start to do that, it becomes a much more enjoyable experience as well, I think, because you're starting to concern yourself with your audience,
Yeah.
what they need, and how to give that to them.
Danny Newcombe says for the first 3 years of his coaching, he just wanted to get through the session, no one to ask him any questions, get his own lead. And again, when you start out, that is like it's survival, isn't it?
It is survival. Yeah, survival mode.
Now, what other things come up a lot in the presentation stuff?
It's all it comes down to behavior, right? In terms of how your audience are going to perceive you and how engaged they're going to be with you when you're talking to them. And I think so much of what we look at is behavioral. So thinking about body language and what's happening with your voice, and am I getting the best out of your voice, and or are you sort of shutting down a little bit and allowing that pressure to inhibit your natural vocal ability? Are you connecting with language and really connecting with the words and sounding like you mean what you're saying? And just having that open body language that you're able to express yourself, use your hands, not worry too much about yourself, and lock yourself up.
Yeah, I like the. I know you speak about the adult and just that they're quite like almost like symmetrical. They're quite still. They're got great listening skills. They've got great noticing skills. I just love that image. I love to be able to get to that image at some point in my life.
Oh, you're there. You're there, Rusty. It's pouring off of you now, mate.
I'm working on it. If people want to get in touch, where's the best place to get hold of you?
missionperformance.com is the new shiny website which we've got up, and it's looking really good. So that's a good place to start.
LinkedIn, you'll be LinkedIn. I can't
I'm
imagine.
on LinkedIn, Paul Checker on LinkedIn. You can find me there. Absolutely. So either of those two routes to success, Rusty. There
Beautiful, beautiful,
you
mate. We'll
go.
look forward to seeing you in May. Yeah, over and out.
Two days in the room together, won't we? It'll be fun. Lovely.
The dream. Yeah, we are literally in the room together. Me, you, and A.
Yes.
It's not
Yeah.
better.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Brilliant.
Amazing. Have a good day.
Thanks a lot, Rusty. Cheers.